This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. On Monday, Kurds in Iraq voted to become an independent Kurdish state. With all the other big news items that have been receiving attention lately, this one didn't get as much press, and most governments don't even acknowledge that this happened. But this is a large ethnic group smack in the middle of the Middle East that is aiming to redraw the borders of the most volatile region on Earth. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Anthony Chabaterwe to discuss how this might factor into the fulfillment of biblical prophecies about this region. There is a form of warfare that takes place in the shadows. It doesn't usually result in telegenic explosions and maneuvers from impressive military hardware. It is cyber warfare, and it's becoming an increasingly common weapon in today's world. It's making more and more headlines. This is a subject we've covered quite a bit over the years at thetrumpet.com, and we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about it, this subject that's becoming more relevant all the time. Society loves the idea of living long, but it hates the idea of getting old. We tend to associate age with aches and pains, declining mental capacity, diminishing productivity. But does it have to be that way? We're going to talk with nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about some solutions to the seemingly inevitable problems of aging. And finally, we'll talk about a bit of wisdom that those involved in the NFL controversy seem to have forgotten. All of this on today's Trumpet Hour. On Monday, Kurds in Iraq overwhelmingly voted to create an independent Kurdish state. There have long been calls for a Kurdish state, but it's opposed by the Iraqi government and just about every other nation as well. It's a subject that raises intense passions among many different peoples, most especially this large ethnic group that is right at the center of the most volatile region on Earth. So the outcome of this predicament really has the potential to have tremendous effect on the region and beyond. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Anthony Chabaterwe. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So let's start by just catching our listeners up to speed on what's going on here. We don't necessarily hear a lot about the Kurds because they don't have a state of their own, but maybe you could just give us the background of who they are and how many of them there are and so on.
Perhaps I'll start maybe by trying to give our listeners a mental picture of the geographic location of Kurdistan, because Kurdistan is not in Central Asia or South Asia. That's
all the other stands.
Yes, there's that region that goes from Kazakhstan all the way down to Pakistan. That's not what Kurdistan is. Kurdistan is in the Middle East. It's actually in northern Iraq. It's a province in northern Iraq. It has been in Iraq since the 1920s, since before World War II. And shortly after World War I, the Middle East was carved up into all these different nations that we have today. And back then, there were promises made to the Kurds that they will have a nation of their own, because the Middle East back then was being carved up around ethnic lines. And they were an ethnic group, but they didn't get a nation of their own. And ever since, they've been pursuing independence. Saddam Hussein, he even signed an autonomy accord with the Kurds, but he betrayed them. He gassed them in 1988. He killed thousands of them. And many of them are still being treated of some of the wounds that they incurred in that attack. So the Kurds have been wanting independence. Even the Iraq after Saddam Hussein has been trying to work with them to give them some sort of independence, but they've all been broken promises. And we know that Iraq is more broken than ever before because of the Islamic State. And in fact, the Kurds have been some of the strongest forces in stopping the Islamic State in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And now they've attained some sort of international legitimacy because of this fight. And now they want a state of their own, and they are asking for it.
Yeah, Mr. Stephen Fleury was talking about it on the Trumpet Daily Radio show on Tuesday, just contrasting, say, the support globally for a Palestinian state versus the almost universal disapproval of a Kurdish state. And yet, when you look at who the Kurds are and say what they have accomplished and how much the United States and other nations have relied on them in supporting the war against terrorism and so on, you would think that they would enjoy more support from in this bid for their independence.
I think that's probably the most important thing that listeners have to ask themselves. Why is it that all these nations are against an independent Kurdistan? And we're talking about nations that normally don't agree on anything, but they're almost unanimous in condemning the establishment of an independent Kurdistan. The United States, it has come out against that. Iran has come out against that. Iraq is against that. Turkey is against Kurdistan.
First of all, maybe what is on the list of the Kurds' reasons for why they deserve it? You talked about how they were promised an independent state. They are their own ethnic group, and it was told them that they would have. As they enumerate their demands, and I think, I don't know what the eventual outcome of that referendum was, but somewhere north of 93% of the Kurds in that area say we want our independent state. What is it that they are insisting are the reasons why this is necessary?
They do feel that the government in Baghdad has neglected their interests, and it has only gotten worse, especially now that Iraq is subservient to Iran, which is predominantly Shiite. Mm-hmm. You know, the Kurds, they are somewhat Sunni, and they are seeing this Iraq emerging that answers to Iran. So they are seeing that, and they are not seeing their interests being considered in Baghdad. In fact, they said that this referendum was unconstitutional. And we also have Kurds in other parts of the Middle East, in Iran itself,
right,
who have been oppressed, who have been marginalized. Same thing in Turkey, same thing in Syria. They've been marginalized, and yet they haven't been that big of a threat. In fact, they have been fighting against terrorism in Syria, in Iraq especially, but they have been marginalized for all these years.
So really, the Kurds who are in northern Iraq, this represents just a portion of the Kurdish population. But if you were to actually just carve a geographical area where the Kurds exist and in fairly high numbers in populace, it does take a portion of all those countries you mentioned: Syria, Turkey, Iran, as well as Iraq. And so all of these countries kind of face this threat of having a portion of their territory carved out away from them. Even just if there were a Kurdish state in northern Iraq, it would embolden and empower the Kurdish populations within these other countries as well, which is essentially why those nations that are right in that area are opposed to the idea, is it not?
Yes, that could inspire a Kurdish spring, so to speak, or even an Arab spring. That happens in the Middle East. We experienced that. We have been experiencing that for the past 6 or 7 years,
right,
particularly in Syria. It's a revolt against the government. It's some sort of a desire, a struggle for independence. The Syrian civil war is somewhat of a fight for independence between these different ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very legitimate concern. Just looking at Israel, for example, Israel has been supporting this independent Kurdistan. And I think the reasons why Israel wants Kurdistan is very revealing. Israel understands what's at stake here, probably more than many other nations. They know that Iran's drive, to dominate the region could be hindered by having this Sunni state right in the middle of the Middle East. That is that understands how dangerous Iran is. So this is something that Israel understands, and it wants to make sure that we don't have Iran dominating the Middle East. So that's pretty significant. And those other nations that are against independent Kurdistan, they have their own national interests for that. And the United States, I think the United States is also revealing why they are not supporting Kurdistan, because the United States relies on the Kurds and has relied on the Kurds in the fight against Islamic terrorism. So you'd expect the United States to want another independent Kurdistan in the region. But it has been opposing that. And I think it's because the United States lacks the will to deal with whatever instability arises from that, because that's likely to happen. I mean, any struggle will have some challenges here and there, good or bad. If the struggle might be good, it might be bad. There are always challenges and complications. You just have to have the willpower to see it through. And I think that the United States is abandoning its ally in the Kurds because it's just lacking the will to deal with another conflict in Iraq. We have lost a lot of money and soldiers in Iraq. I think the United States doesn't want more of that. So that's a very complicated situation, and we could see this destabilizing the Middle East even more.
Well, it is interesting that Israel's and the United States' positions on this subject would be so divergent from one another that Israel is almost singularly supportive of it. There are very few nations that support this idea. Most are very opposed to it, including the United States. But so looking at this, the way that you're talking about it, and that's an interesting view, that it, maybe it's just the United States, that it is a, it would be a good idea that it would maybe help create a state that would be more amenable to the interests of Israel and the West. That might be certainly more than Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran have proven to be. But looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, how significant is this? How does this play out based on what we know? This is not something that is referred to specifically, but if you're able to kind of piece out what the likely outcome would be, what would you say?
Like you said, Kurdistan is not mentioned directly in the Bible, but we all know that Israel is, the United States is, Iran is, Turkey is mentioned in the Bible. And we're talking about a region that the Bible tells us to watch closely. And right now, there are talks about instability arising from Kurdistan. In fact, Turkey has already stationed its troops next to the Kurdish border. They are conducting military exercises there. Iran has said it'll do the same thing. Turkey is telling the Kurds that you should give up on this push for independence, otherwise you're gonna go hungry. So there are problems right now in the Middle East, and we don't know exactly how they'll play out, but we know that this is a conflict that could spread throughout the region. It could affect Syria, and we know in the Bible that we expect Syria to realign away from Iran. We don't know exactly how that will play out, but it could have something to do with the Kurds in Syria, because right now they are trying to pull away from Syria. And if more conflict continues in Syria, we can see Assad losing his power, and we can see Iran losing its grip on Syria. And that's something that the Bible has prophesied. Same thing in Iraq. We know that Iran has this strong hold on Iraq, and it has already gained a lot in Iraq, and it will probably try to do whatever it can to retain that grip on Iraq. So it might retain that power on Iraq, but what happens in the process? Which other nations is it likely to push in that fight to maintain its grip on Iraq? We don't know exactly, but we do know that there are going to be some powers who are going to be concerned about what's happening in the Middle East and intervene. And that is Germany and Europe. So this is just a small step that could develop into what the Bible has prophesied to happen in this region.
Well, you do wonder with the Kurds going ahead and proceeding with this vote in spite of warnings from the Iraqi government and certainly a lot of pressure from other nations to avoid holding this referendum, the United States included. The fact that they were bold enough to proceed with it and to vote in the kind of numbers that they did for independence, it does make you wonder just how this is going to unfold, whether you would think that they would continue to get bolder until basically someone put a stop to it, that the pressure for them to proceed with this and actually create an autonomous area or to declare themselves independent, that would provoke some kind of backlash maybe from some of these other countries that you're talking. Definitely a situation that would be good to continue to watch because it's kind of a wild card in the Middle East in these countries that really do feature so heavily in biblical prophecy. If you, just to direct someone to more information on this, do you have any thoughts on where you would point them to?
Yes, Trumpeter Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written a booklet. It's titled The King of the South, and that booklet talks about Iran's prophesied dominance of the Middle East. It also talks about this alliance of nations. We call it the Psalm 83 alliance that indicates that Syria is going to be pulled away from Iran's influence. Mm-hmm. So these are very intriguing prophecies that our readers and our listeners can learn more about if they go to our website and order The King of the South.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chabaterwe. He also has an article he's written for thetrumpet.com called Is the Middle East Ready for an Independent Kurdistan? You can watch for that there. He also links to the booklets that he described and a couple of videos that explain those prophecies if you're interested in following up. We certainly appreciate your effort to study into this and to report on it for us and for giving us your time today.
Good to be here.
The voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Cyber warfare is becoming an increasingly common weapon that groups and nations are using against each other. It's making its way into headlines all over, from attacks on states like Ukraine and the Baltic states, the Stuxnet attack on Iran's nuclear program here in the United States. There was talk of how cyber attacks affected our last presidential election. It's a subject we've spoken about quite a bit over the years at The Trumpet, and it's becoming more relevant all the time. Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood has written an article that gives a terrific overview of this trend for thetrumpet.com. He's here to talk about it. Hello, Kieran.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I said you're here, but you're actually in our British office and we're right. Connected via Skype. But I'd like to get you start talking about just what inspired you to get into this subject.
Well, on September 6th, there was an American software company called Symantec, and they reported that a hacking group known as Dragonfly had gained unprecedented access to electrical facilities across America and even in Europe as well. So Symantec reported on this. A few other news outlets reported on it. But overall, not a lot of people heard about this, that hackers were inside the electric grid with access there. And if you're not really interested in cybersecurity, then you probably have never heard of it. The reason being that while they're inside, they haven't done anything. They haven't shut down your own power in your own home. They have access, but right now they're not using that access. And that's really what would be ideal for anyone who's going to hack into anything. The perfect hack job would be where you get in, you search around, you do what you want, and you pull out, and nobody knows you've even done it.
Right. So, when they're doing this, well, let's just talk about some of the dangers that can come from that. If people are accessing information that they shouldn't, and they're also gaining access to maybe controls and powers that they shouldn't have access to, what are some of the ripple effects and ramifications that can come from that?
Well, I'll go back to a Ukrainian hack that happened in 2015 and then happened again the next year in 2016. And these were about nearly exactly a year apart. Now, in 2015, right at the end of the year, there were these Ukrainian engineers who were sitting in front of their computers at their power station, and they see beyond their control their mouse just moving across the screen, and they can't do anything about it. They no longer have control over their own mice, and they watch these hackers in what's now called a phantom mouse move across their screens, close breakers, shut down power grids. And on that night, up to 200,000 Ukrainians had their power shut off while the engineers just watched their computer screens in disbelief that hackers had got in there and were controlling a nation's, or in this case, the companies that gave energy to a nation, their power grid. So they pretty much took out whatever they wanted, and it took about 6 hours for the engineers to shut down, restart manually in order to get those 200,000 people their power back.
Okay, so 2015, and then a year later they came back again.
They did it, and this time it was even more advanced. As Wired, who did extensive reports on these attacks, said the hackers, this is in 2016, could have done much more damage than they did do if they had only decided to physically destroy substation equipment as well, making it much harder to restore power. They were saying if they decided to do more things and they had the capability to do it, then it could have been even worse. And what they were reporting after the event, as people researched it and analyzed what the hackers did, is they decided or figured out that the hackers could have done more if they wanted, and it was more likely to be a trial run, just testing to see what they could do rather than going all out, which is something very scary.
And this was presumably Russian hackers, is that right?
Presumably, the Ukrainian government said straight away, this is Russian hackers. They think it's definite. A lot of people are not exactly sure. It's very hard to track.
So let's just talk about more of these ramifications here. If you have hackers hacking into Ukraine and they're controlling power grids and they're actually able to shut down power, and they're doing this in ways that they demonstrated capabilities that could have made the destructive potential of the attack far more serious than what happened. But this could, we've seen similar types of breaks in security elsewhere, including the United States, have we not?
Yeah, and a man who worked on and investigated these Ukrainian hacks, his name's Robert Lee, said that the virus that was used in Ukraine, called Black Energy, has already been planted in American infrastructure once before. So he says, he has another quote somewhere where he's talking about Washington, D.C., and he said, if a nation state or hackers backed by a nation state were to try and take that out, they could do it easily. They could take it out for a month if they were really trying.
Well, how much has the United States, how capable are we of preventing or defending ourselves against this? Is this a thing where we recognize that there's an attack going on and we just say, okay, we'll shut the computer off and we'll just run it manually with the people who are there in the stations?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because the one thing that saved the Ukrainian engineers was their ability to return to manual control, their power grids. In America, and it's becoming more like this in America, there's less power stations that actually even have the ability to go back to manual control. There are some, On top of that, you have fewer and fewer engineers who even know how to operate the manual controls if they were needed to do that. So there's a lot of systems in America which are more advanced than the Ukrainians based on computers or automated, but that actually in sometimes becomes a weakness for someone who's in your computer and your computer system has control. If you don't know how to return to manual control, then it makes it the scenario even worse.
So this is something that has been discussed for decades, the potential for pretty catastrophic destruction because of computer hacking and cyber warfare. How much has the our ability to protect ourselves against this type of thing improved? How much has security improved in order to keep these things from happening? Because it seems like as great as the threat has been to this point, we've avoided a widespread kind of event that has really been, at least within America, has gained a lot of press. But is it a matter of, is our reliance any less than it was, say, when this was first being discussed a couple of decades ago? Or is it actually even become, have we gotten even more vulnerable?
Well, in the way that Robert Lee describes it, there are certain aspects which have definitely become more vulnerable with more things being automated. What is not driving investment in cybersecurity is the fact that we haven't had, or America has not had, any major attacks. And the reason for that being, if a nation state were to really attack and to bring down an American power grid, it would be all out war. You can imagine that it's instantly a huge blow to a country. And if you were to find out who did that, there would be troops on the ground as soon as possible. So no one's going to try these blatant attacks on a superpower like America right now, unless they're willing to go to war for it. And there's been a number of studies talking about, or scenarios talking about, what would happen if you were in that state of war where someone went out of their way to attack America's power grid. Lloyd's of London, which is actually an insurance market, was so worried about the effects of all the insurance that it would have to pay if something like this would happen, that it went and built its own scenarios based on information that we already know, hacks that already had happened. And it estimated that with a success rate of only 10%, if hackers were to only be successful in 10% of their work, they would be able to shut down 50 power grids across the United States, cut off power to nearly 93 million people, and the ramifications would just go on and on. They said $243 billion of damage. You know, workplaces become empty for those days. Stores become looted. Riders fill the street. All these ramifications of not having your power for a certain amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, so we, in one sense, you're talking about just the inability of people to imagine just how bad things can get. And so the motivation to defend against what seems like an illusory threat isn't great enough to throw the kind of resources at this problem that it would really warrant.
Exactly. Some studies looked at the amount of damage that weather, just extreme weather events, caused to the power grid, and compared that to the potential attacks or the attacks that had already happened on electric grids. And they would say, look at this massive disparity. You have thunderstorms, which cost thousands times more than any hacker has ever done in the United States. So, of course, we should put all of our funding into these preventing or
defending against the threat that we know about.
Yeah, because it hasn't happened yet. And of course, it's pretty dangerous thinking. But at the same time, America does have one of the most sophisticated offensive cyber armies. But one thing that even one official in the U.S. government said is that although we have peers, we have competitors in the cyber army market. And at right now, he's talking about the advantages that we have on the ground in our Navy and our Army. But he says right now in cyber warfare, it's a level playing field. And that's what makes this man very, very uncomfortable. That was the former U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff who was saying that in an interview. It's a level playing field because we really don't even know the potential of other countries because their job is to remain unseen, of course.
Right. And you could definitely see other nations that are completely unable to compete with the United States in terms of conventional warfare and the other advantages that the Americans have militarily, and yet being able to throw relatively small amount of resources toward cyber attacks and have an outsized effect and damage to the United States because of the nature of the warfare. The level playing field that he's talking about, or asymmetric warfare, really is compelling. We look at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. Maybe you can just talk about what it is about it prophetically that makes this such a compelling subject.
Okay, well, I think we'll go back to a 1999 personal by Mr. Gerald Flurry. He quoted an Intelligence Digest by Joseph DeCourcy, and he was warning of computer crime, computer terrorism, and computer warfare. And at that time, he said, one growing concern to Western security authorities is the expanding semi-underground network of young computer hackers in Germany. So he was pointing to this, and this was back nearly 20 years ago, of this threat, this cybersecurity threat from Germany. And then Mr. Flurry went on to call this America's Achilles heel. Could possibly be that Achilles heel that allows a huge superpower to be taken down. He quoted this scripture in Ezekiel 7:14, where it says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle." And then he describes the scenario. The trumpet of war is to be blown in Israel, mainly in America and Britain. Then it seems everybody is expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. And then he asks, will it be because of computer terrorism? We've seen a lot of developments in the German cyber capabilities. This year, in April 5, Germany's Minister of Defense, Ursula von der Leyen, announced the official start of the German cyber army, or their technology and warfare group. They announced that it was going to be 13,500 computer specialists, and they began. And this, at the time, von der Leyen said, this puts us in the top field internationally of cyber warfare. She went on in her inaugural address to say, if Germany's military's networks are attacked, then we can defend ourselves, which of course is how they would want to portray it usually. But she went on to say, as soon as attack endangers the functional and operational readiness of combat forces, we can respond with offensive measures. And as anybody in the cybersecurity area knows, you can't just play defense. You can't just swat away your attacks. In order to effectively disengage the enemy, you have to go and attack, which is exactly why the Germans have increased their cyber army from nearly non-existent to 13,500 people.
That's some impressive capabilities. We wrote about that earlier in the year. I think it was Richard Palmer wrote an article about that very subject. And you can find that if you go to thetrumpet.com. We've been talking with trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about this article that he has written. The title of this is Why the Trumpet Watches America's Cyber Vulnerabilities. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. If it hasn't posted yet, it's going to post quite soon. And he links to Gerald Flurry's article, America's Achilles Heel and Germany, and also this other article, Germany Prepares for the War of the Future. All of these available there on thetrumpet.com. Those two previous articles you can just find through the search bar. But we've been talking with Kieran Underwood. We really appreciate you bringing that to us, Kieran. It's a fascinating subject and one that I'm sure that we're going to be hearing more about in the time ahead.
Thanks very much.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Society loves the idea of living long, but it hates the idea of getting old. Generally, it seems that as we age, we hurt. The aches and pains set in. A lot of cases, our thinking slows down, and we become less productive members of society. That may be the case a lot of the time, but does it have to be that way? Is there a solution to the seemingly inevitable problems associated with aging? To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hi there.
Well, let's talk about lifespans, first of all. People are living a lot longer than they used to. And how is this happening, and how long are people living now compared to, say, 100 years ago?
Well, if you believe the news, the last 100 years have been the most radical period of life extension in human history. Breakthroughs like the germ theory or antibiotics, as well as public health advances in sanitation, have neutralized a lot of the leading causes of death. So as a result, we've jumped from a pre-modern life expectancy of roughly around 30 years around the globe to one where it's set today. We live, most countries live to be about, have a life expectancy of about 60 years of age and beyond. But even more so, developed countries are pushing almost 80 today. So that's significant. And it kind of stokes the expectation that we're going to continue to get older and happier. But studies now show that there is this upward trajectory does have a ceiling. So, and we seem to have hit that ceiling roughly around that 80 years to 120. And I believe that 122 was the oldest living person ever on record. And she died in 1997. Her name was Jean Comand.
That's amazing. A woman who died in 1997 who would have been alive during, say, the American Reconstruction period. That's phenomenal. So if we prize getting older or if we prize long life so much, what is it about getting older that gives us so much trouble?
Isn't that interesting? There's the disconnect between the fantasy of I want to live a really long time, but I really hate the thought of the process of getting old because, you know, I'm getting wrinkly, I'm getting slower, I may have pain or disease. There's a lot of vanity involved in that. And so you'll see people mask those imperfections of aging with creams and Botox and pharmaceutical aids and perhaps even plastic surgery. And it doesn't look like there's anything off limits today in treating aging as a curable disease. And you'll hear those words, a curable disease. Aging is a disease. The problem is, as far back as the 1960s, scientists found that human cells can only divide 40 to 60 times. And after that, it stops. So that's called the Hayflick limit. And it indicates that even if pharmaceuticals are involved, they might be okay at suspending aging or giving you what's called a quality of life, but the end game, the life, the maximum lifespan, that end game, that stays the same. So now we want a longer life. We want the beauty associated with youth into the long life, and we want no diseases as a society. But we want to break the law, every law of health imaginable. While we're doing it, you know, so we want to expend as little effort as possible to achieve that as well, you know, but longer life is a worthless price if quality is compromised, and you're going to compromise the quality if you're just looking at vanity and you're going to have that poor health. So perhaps a way to look at that is spending those vast resources that we spend on vanity, perhaps instead of going towards lengthening the duration of old age, spend in good health.
Right. So it's really, it seems like, and I know that there is quite a bit of effort being put toward this, is expanding the quality of life, the length of a good quality life where you're taking care of yourself in a way that enables you to maintain your independence, that your strength and your mobility and some of those basic health factors, that those are being extended. It's not so much a matter of trying to eliminate wrinkles as it is a matter of trying to stave off some of the decline that inevitably sets in as we get older?
Well, that's true. I think the bigger thing that we have to look at when we reach that older age is, what is the resiliency of the body? What can we still do as a productive member of society? And in reality, the aging process is less fixed than most people think. I mean, a person's physical health before the age of 50 is probably the greatest determinant to aging well. Hmm. So essentially, if we're taking care of ourselves before we get old, we're going to have a lot more success.
So you don't want to say start to take care of yourself when you hit 50, when you've already started to experience some of the breakdowns that happened because you weren't taking care of yourself.
Well, of course, it's like a car. I mean, you don't want to let that car just go to rust and then say, wow, I better take care of it. I see vehicles out there that are from the 1940s, 1950s, and people are just lovingly taking care of them, and they're still purring away. It's the same with the human body. Having said that, and that is the greatest way to do it, the best way, it's never too late. Mm-hmm. You know, we never want to say we can't do anything, because it's almost amazing when a person starts within weeks and months, not even years, what a difference in quality of life that it does, say, a lifestyle change for the better. So we look at older people right now as medicated, as stupefied, as being senile. I mean, that's just the way that society looks at seniors, and that's wrong. That's just a wrong way to look at it, because it's not even true in a lot of cases. I think a lot of old people just rely on those band-aid medical solutions that keep them walking, but in a fairly decrepit stage, and that really prevents them from thinking about the lifestyle changes as well. And that's the wrong way to go about it. They should really look at it as saying, look, I need to keep myself in good health. And there are ways to do that.
Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, isn't it? That how much of the, say, the loss of respect that society pays to the elderly is because of the elderly failing to continue to contribute, and how much of it is the elderly feeling that they don't have anything to contribute just because society seems so uninterested in them. It puts so much of a priority on young people. In a sense, if you have an approach like, well, I want to maintain my productivity and my health as much as I can, you're kind of taking matters into your own hands and taking more of a proactive approach in trying to maintain health and productivity into your old age. And that's a much more empowering message than just, well, I guess I don't have anything to contribute because I'm just getting old.
Right. And we do have those stereotypes, of course. The stereotypes exist in the media, the conversations, in the literature, and these shape social health experiences and work experiences. Of course, they're out there. But we don't have to listen to those. No one says you have to listen to that. The biggest block is a mental block, is in the elderly accepting the fact that they should be something that society says. And they have to take it upon themselves to say, no, that's not true. I can be full of vigor. I can contribute to society. Very good. The elderly need success like any other people. So instead of retirement, forced retirement, you can continue to lead a very productive life. There was a 2014 Wall Street Journal that says knowledge and certain types of intelligence just continue to develop in ways that even offset age-related cognitive declines in a brain. It deepens expertise and even enhances productivity and creativity. I mean, you're getting an employee, an elderly employee, that is far wiser and makes far wiser decisions. There's study upon study showing that, and they outperform the younger generation.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So if you, just looking at this from a practical standpoint, what sorts of steps could a person take at whatever age they are in anticipation of, or even to try to fulfill right now, more resiliency, more vigor, more strength in their later years?
Well, the biggest thing is staying active mentally and physically. Social factors are predictive of very successful aging and offsetting those age-related cognitive declines. In fact, the people who stay socially active have a 50% chance of living longer. I mean, that's crazy. And as well, you know, we have the usual that if you look at exercise, it's a vital part of increasing mobility, keeping yourself mobile, keeping the chronic risk diseases down, strengthening muscles and bones, and preventing that early death. And then you combine that with eating good. I mean, make sure that you're getting proper nutrition to age well. You know, don't look at fast foods and sugar and white food groups or fried foods because they're quick and they're easy. Stay in that kitchen and continue to cook to take care of your body. So those are the big ways, the big three, I would say, that elderly can really help themselves to stay active in older age.
Okay, so keeping yourself mentally active, physically active, and then watching your diet.
Watching diet, and as well, right, and the social aspect of making sure you're around lots of people, being involved in the community, reading, taking more classes if you have to. Keep that mind active to stay healthy.
Yeah. I love the idea of the fact that older people do have unique contributions to make because of their experience and because of having greater wisdom gained from those experiences. You do definitely see that in some people. It wouldn't be across the board. If somebody is getting older and they're not really challenging themselves, they're not necessarily gaining extra wisdom from those experiences. But there are certain, if somebody really is remaining active the way that you're describing, there is wisdom there that's just simply not available to the person who hasn't had those experiences.
We can look at examples in history, and some of the greatest leaders that we've had were elder statesmen. You know, we can look at that and we can take great inspiration from that. Winston Churchill is one that springs to my mind. And he really reached the apex of leadership when he was over 65. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what a mistake it would have been for him to retire too early before arguably becoming one of the most influential leaders in history and helping to save mankind during World War II. If you took this man today, he'd be ridiculed and scorned. But at that time, he was the person, an elder statesman, who was influential in that aspect of world history. So, yes, those examples are out there, and they're very, you know, we can look at those and just draw great inspiration from them.
Well, fantastic stuff. We've been talking with Jorg Mardian, a nutritionist and personal trainer up in British Columbia. He's working on an article on this subject, how to age gracefully and remain productive into your later years. You can watch for that article on thetrumpet.com. Jorg, that's a lot of food for thought there. We appreciate you bringing it to us.
It's been my pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
I'm the victim. You have offended me. That's the way more and more people in the world today are being taught to think. We live in a world of microaggressions and trigger words, a world where everyone needs sensitivity training to avoid offending other people around them. Is there anything wrong with this? I mean, the idea that we don't want to offend people, that's certainly not a bad idea. But this concept of victimization ignores the fact that we are responsible for how we respond to people. If somebody says something to you that you don't like, you choose your response. If somebody says something offensive, you can actually choose not to be offended. You can just as easily as get offended, give that person the benefit of the doubt. Well, he probably didn't intend it. Maybe he was thinking of something else. Maybe he didn't realize how he was coming across. We all have tough days. Maybe he had a headache. Any one of those ideas would prevent the kind of antagonism and problems that tend to result from being oversensitive and being touchy. I recently read the story of a man. He was a restaurant manager, very positive man. People would ask him, "How you doing, Jerry?" He'd say, if I were any better, I would be twins. He was a really fantastic guy to work for. And someone asked him, well, how do you stay so positive? He said, well, each morning I wake up and I tell myself, Jerry, you have two choices today. You can either be in a good mood or in a bad mood. I choose to be in a good mood. If something bad happens, I can either choose to be a victim or I can choose to learn from it. If somebody complains, I can accept those complaints or I can point out the positive. And the person said, yeah, right. It's not that easy. He said, yes, it is. Life is all about choices. When you cut away the junk, every situation is a choice. You choose how you react to situations. You choose how people will affect your mood. You choose to be in a good mood or a bad mood. That's the bottom line. It's your choice how you live your life. Well, years later, after that conversation, Jerry was working in his restaurant and he made the mistake of leaving the back door of the restaurant open. Any restaurant manager knows that's a no-no. Three armed robbers came into the restaurant. They held Jerry at gunpoint. As he was fumbling for the safe, he got a little bit nervous, and one of the armed robbers made the mistake of shooting him. Jerry lay on the floor, and he thought, I have a choice, to die or to live. I choose to live. The paramedics came to the restaurant, and they were working on him. They said, you know, he's going to be fine. They brought him on the ambulance, took him to the emergency room, wheeled him through the doors, and Jerry looked up and he saw the faces of the doctors, and he got scared. He could see in the eyes of these doctors, this guy is a dead man. And there was a big nurse there shouting questions at him, saying, are you allergic to anything? And Jerry summoned up his strength and said, yes. The doctors and the nurses all stopped working and they waited for his reply. He took a deep breath and he said, bullets! And they all burst out laughing. It was a very tense situation that was immediately broken by the way that Jerry responded in the situation. And he told the doctors, I am choosing to live. Operate on me as if I'm alive, not dead. Well, he did live. And a big part of the reason was because of his choice to live. How do you choose when someone offends you? Someone says something that could be taken as offensive, something that's insensitive, something that isn't well considered. Well, believe it or not, the law of God actually has some wisdom on this point. In the book of Leviticus, in the 19th chapter, there are a few verses here that just have some wonderful wisdom that prevent us from getting into troublesome situations with other people. Verse 17 of Leviticus 19 says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You know, Jesus Christ, when he was on this earth, he said that it was actually violating the spirit of the law against murder to hate someone. Well, you know, he did not invent that himself. It's right there enshrined within the law of the Old Testament. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. God actually cares about what you think of other people. Even if you don't say anything negative about them, God's law forbids hatred in your heart. Are you judgmental and critical of other people? Do you hold grudges against people? We're talking about the spirit of God's law. This is a spirit of the law that has always existed. God has always been concerned about what happens within your heart, and it's always been against hatred. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. God wants our hearts to be full of love for people, not hate. It says, you shall in any wise rebuke your neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. You shall not avenge. If you happen to feel like somebody does something wrong to you, don't take vengeance. Don't retaliate. Don't lash back at them. And then it says, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Eternal. Did you know that the law of God forbids us to even bear grudges? Again, this is about what's going on in your heart. That phrase, bear a grudge, means to cherish anger or hold on to feelings of ill will God commands that we not bear a grudge. Even if we feel like we've been done wrong by, we have to be willing to let it go. And it's all about that principle enshrined at the end of verse 18. But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. How do you want to be treated? You don't want people being oversensitive around you, judging you, harboring bitterness against you, holding grudges, assuming the worst about you. You appreciate it when they believe the best about you. You don't have to walk on eggshells around them. You know that they can see past your imperfections. They give you the benefit of the doubt. Obviously, we all need to exercise social graces and proper etiquette around each other. But we also want to feel like we're free to be ourselves and that people accept us and appreciate us for who we are and that they love us in spite of our flaws. That's exactly the kind of kindness toward others that we need to demonstrate. There's a wonderful truth contained in Psalm 119 and verse 165. It says, "Great peace have they which love your law, and nothing shall offend them." This is how to avoid being offended. This is how to not get worked up over petty things. This is how to have peace in your relationships, peace in your mind, peace in your heart. Love God's law. Love that wonderful law of love, God's wonderful, precious law of love, and nothing will offend you. I'm Joel Hilliker. That is it for this edition of Trumpet Hour. Send your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests today, Anthony Chabotterwe, Kieran Underwood, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Eleanor Roosevelt. When you cease to make a contribution, you begin to die. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.